Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
Hey guys, so this is our second live stream that we did on the second order effects of coronavirus, all the different societal, political, economic effects that are already happening and could potentially happen. This is a live stream that went out on March 16th, so we're publishing it a little bit later on the podcast here. A lot of it is still super relevant, and some of the things that we talk about here actually ended up happening in the world. So I hope you like it, and for more resources on preparing for the lockdown, which a lot of us are actually already experiencing, I think 2 billion people in the world are on lockdown right now, you can go to futurethinkers.org/COVIDprep. And if you're having trouble processing the emotional fallout of what's happening right now, if you're experiencing grief, you can go to futurethinkers.org/COVIDgrief. All right, let's get into this. Yeah, this thing has unfolded very quickly, and for anyone who has been paying attention to this for a while, it's probably no surprise, but for some people who just kind of clued in that this is a big deal recently, it might feel like hitting them like a ton of bricks. But we're already starting to see societal effects happening, obviously, in Italy. Hospitals are overwhelmed. Doctors are having to choose who lives and who dies. So they're doing triage because there are just simply not enough ventilators for people who can't breathe. And if you look at the exponential charts of the growth of the virus in other countries, a lot of countries are just a few days or maybe weeks behind Italy, and they're following the exact same exponential curve. So unless countries start taking measures, shit is going to hit the fan there in the same way that it did in Wuhan and in Italy, just in a matter of days.
Speaking of shit hitting the fan, we've been working on a lot more articles lately. wait, that was a great segue, wasn't it? The most recent one that we put out there was COVID grief how to respond to the kind of emotional fallout of having things collapse around you. You can check that out at futurethinkers.org/COVID grief.
Yeah.
And you've got your prep doc as well.
Yeah, I did an article last week, and some of it might be already kind of too late for that, but there's still some relevant stuff, and that's how to prepare. And that's at futurethinkers.org/COVID prep. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, we've been talking to some people, and some people have already started noticing cash shortages. You know, some people have gone basically out of business because of the shutdowns or because people are afraid to travel or afraid, you know, to they don't go out and spend money. So people who work in the restaurant industry or in any sort of industry where it's in person have really suffered. And we're going to see that a lot more. And especially for people who don't have any savings, who live paycheck to paycheck, this is going to impact them in a massive way. So, you know, people kind of obsess over the death rates, but we're probably going to see way more bankruptcies than deaths mm-hmm. from this.
Which, you know, has cascading effects in itself, depression rates, suicide rates, crime rates.
Yeah.
I've even heard rumors that some countries are seeing increased rates in divorce.
Yeah, this is actually data that one of the Chinese provinces published, that the registry office noticed a spike in divorce rates mm-hmm. because couples were locked together in quarantine and probably experiencing financial difficulties as well. And, you know, divorces happen.
Mm-hmm. I was talking with my dad the other day, and he's quite depressed about the whole change in social etiquette.
Yeah.
You know, my family's very social, very like...
Yeah,
we like to get together in groups, have some drinks, hug, that kind of stuff. And it's already been quite depressing and affecting them just to not be able to do that.
Yeah, especially for people who are extroverted, where they really get their, you know, energy from mm-hmm. socializing. This is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. So, I've known a lot of my family are in the service industry as well. Like my brother bartends and manages and service industries like that. My sister's a hairdresser. It's like these things are, already affecting them. Mm-hmm. We've got some friends who join the calls with us on Future Thinkers who are now like, their parents are both out of business now and they're going to, you know, live on a farm and just kind of exit and tap out of city living.
Yeah, well, and cities obviously are going to get much more strict measures because there's population density and just more people packed into a smaller piece of land. So, you know, all these kinds of strict lockdowns are probably going to affect people a lot more in the city. So I understand. I mean, if you have the ability to go live in the countryside, if you have, you know, parents or somebody who owns a cottage and you can do that, awesome. But not everybody can do that. So. Yeah.
Our booking manager and podcast production person lives in Serbia, and they recently went under lockdown.
State of emergency yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah. So she is having to go out and get groceries. I think the laws in Serbia are a little more strict depending on the age range. So if you're in the more vulnerable category, which is like 60 or 70 years plus.
Yeah, something like that.
Then you're really not allowed to leave. Like quarantine measures are quite strict.
Yeah, they're basically arrest.
Yeah, so she's having to go out and get groceries, run errands for like multiple people, family members, neighbors, that kind of thing. So just in that, there's a lot more of a demand for kind of social care, you know, stepping back and helping out with the family, that kind of thing, which mm-hmm. also takes away your ability to make income. Mm-hmm. So this is a lot of effects that in my mind for the last several years, I've been thinking this would happen as a result of job automation. I've cared a lot about the subject of universal basic income. And I thought this stuff was going to be like 10 years down the road where we were going to be dealing with this. And suddenly here we are and all of the problems are happening all at once. There's no one to blame. The whole concept of UBI is being depoliticized. It's now an emergency situation. So I thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit too, because I don't know. I don't see a whole lot of other solutions. If for several years already, we've been so close to the edge, like our ability to live is dependent on our ability to be working all the time. And now that that's gone, we don't have the ability to live anymore.
Yeah. And also because people are not self-sufficient in any way these days, like they don't grow their own food and they're very isolated from everybody else, that it's the precariat, as Guy Standing has called it. So people are in a very precarious situation. I think 70% of United States lives paycheck to paycheck. And I don't know what those numbers are for other countries, but this is just a stat that I saw yesterday. And I think United States is actually going to be impacted very, very badly mm-hmm. by this pandemic, worse than other countries, because in Europe, at least they have socialized healthcare. And so as well in Canada and in Australia. But in the States, if people don't go to work, they don't make money. And then the healthcare is not covered by the government. So they can't even get tested for COVID. So you were saying that, you know, emergency UBI, emergency universal basic income, would really help in this situation. And it would be a premise to institute it.
Yeah, I was thinking this the other day. I was actually partway through an article a few weeks ago, and then all of this COVID stuff started coming up and I just wasn't thinking about it as much. But I was partway through an article about UBI and the kind of the unexpected benefits I thought there would be. Kind of explosions of art and creativity and invention and that kind of stuff. Because even myself, and I'm not claiming to be like a grand inventor of anything or doing anything that special, but it's like I was locked up in a full-time 40, 50-hour a week job in Vancouver washing dishes and serving tables and stuff and could not make any more than was necessary to just pay my rent and feed myself. And there was like a period of 5 years where I was just trying to make ends meet and could have been working on the things that we're working on now. The only way I got out of that was just you and I left. Mm-hmm. So I know that there's a lot of potential locked up in the necessity to be working. And now that potential, I think, is very precarious. It's been, in some ways, it's been unlocked because people have a lot of time on their hands if they're in lockdown. So there are some immediate benefits as well to this. I think if people can kind of collectivize, create group intelligence, collective intelligences, and then start problem solving around this stuff, there is potential. I do see a lot of opportunities in what COVID-19 has shown for us. Oh, is he crying now?
Yeah.
He is. Okay. We got to take a baby break.
But you can maybe continue talking about this
monologue.
Yeah.
Right.
Lockdown parent life.
Yeah. Just maybe you can bring him in here. I don't know. David, talk to me. You're muted, I think.
All right, I'm unmuted now.
So David, you might have seen, he's helping us with the camera movement today, but he's been on, you haven't been on any podcasts, but you've been on live streams and group calls, the Verveke watch parties. So I can't exactly show your face without having to do a lot of technical setup, but maybe you can chat here.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I think what you've talked about so far is really key. The biggest thing that I've been paying attention to, I always go meta. So I'm thinking about the broad scope of how do we make sense of this on a big scale? And it's hard. The practical, I think there are two things that I think about. One is, what does everybody need to know? Like practical day-to-day things. What we're starting to talk about are near-term downstream impacts. How do we deal with the financial impacts of this, job impacts of this, as well as, you know, the medical aspect? And like you said, I think that you're right. The United States is in a different kind of situation. I was impressed or surprised, actually, that the current graph shows the same trajectory in the United States and elsewhere. Pretty much a few Japanese countries that have that dealt with SARS are the only ones who are really looking like they're having activity that's slowing it down. So the downstream impacts are going to be large, and trying to figure out how do we deal with that creatively, bringing our own individual sovereignty to add to collective sovereignty is going to be the biggest challenge. And so those are my thoughts, but that kind of informs the reason that I pay attention to you guys is because you are really good about paying attention to the downstream impacts on the street level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing that we touched on in our last live stream is the emotional and mental consequences of this. And we're already seeing this. Like, we have a friend who is just so stressed. Like, she's not sleeping. She's, you know, she saw somebody try to commit suicide and it really impacted her. I guess I don't know what this person's story is, but she saw somebody on the train and they were going to jump in front of the train. And so she was really, you know, stressed out by that and thinking about how much that's going to keep happening. And there are also other kind of hidden costs, you know, people who they might be elderly or mentally ill, who are just isolated for whatever reason, or maybe single moms, like people who are going to need help, but might not have anybody to help them. How challenging that's going to be.
Just with the schools being shut down, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly, and this is an example, like we've, our babysitter couldn't come and is afraid of like infecting everyone. So it's like, you know, and this is happening all over the states and all over the world, basically. Anywhere there are schools shut down, now kids have to be home, and now parents have to deal with that.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't seem like that big of a problem. I wouldn't have thought it would be that big, but now that I have him, I'm like, oh, wait, everything stops if your kid, if you have to be taking care of your kid the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we talked about the divorce rates increasing. So that's like a month into lockdown. Can you imagine if the lockdown is 3 months or 4 months?
Yeah.
Because we're just at the start of this pandemic.
Yeah, and you've been so abusive with me already. Sorry, had to do it.
Yeah, just imagine, you know, for 3 or 4 months. I saw somebody posted like a poll. After this quarantine is over, because in Bulgaria we've been in lockdown since Friday, so it's been a few days. After this quarantine is over, which outcome do you think is most likely for you? 10 kilos overweight, alcoholic, pregnant, divorced, all of the above.
Yeah. Yeah. Baby boom coming in 9 months. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the UBI thing, do we want to keep going on that or?
Well, I think it's a pretty obvious solution, and especially for a place like United States that is more at risk of being hit by this, because there are so many people working paycheck to paycheck, and there's, I don't know what the laws are for Social Security, like if people get any kind of unemployment insurance if they're working on a no contract deal. I don't think they do.
Well, a lot of people have been moving to contract type employment instead of employee and becoming an employee, which means you're responsible for a lot of your own benefits and taxes, everything.
A lot of people are on a no contract at all. Yeah. So they don't even get guaranteed hours for the week.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So in my mind, I mean, obviously, we've talked about the grief thing. The last time we did one of these live streams, that's pretty much all we talked about. I wrote this big article about this subject. Yeah. I think that's a very important thing. How do we process the grief? Because things are changing and it's going to get harder. We got to be able to deal with that because we cannot make good decisions if we're, you know, panicked and angry and going through the 7 stages of grief and in denial of the situation, which is another thing that's happening. Like I've noticed a lot of people not wanting to face the truth of this and therefore denying its existence and going about life as business as usual. So that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's number one, learn how to process this stuff. And then to me, I mean, I'll speak for myself. In my life, the number two, I have 3 priorities: take care of the family, deal with the grief stuff and help others deal with the grief stuff. And then out there in the world, we've always been asking, like, what's the out there in the world task? People have asked us that a lot related to like the Future Thinkers community. To me, it's basic income. It's like hashtag emergency UBI. That's the best thing that can come out of this. This is giving us a lot of opportunity to I don't want to say, you know, that old saying, like, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Mm.
I know there's opportunists out there that are kind of jumping in, like buying all the hand sanitizer off the shelves and stuff. But this is also kind of a moment for all of society to look at the situation we're in and reflect. And then because we're all in the same boat, start to take the action. Like, we have the motivation to take action that we've never had before.
Yeah. Crisis is always a catalyst for change.
Yeah.
So we have this great opportunity to create social change. And I know that it's extremely stressful because people have stuff happening in their personal lives too. But at the same time, now is the time to make change because there's precedent for it.
Mm-hmm. And I've been in a number of situations where I've seen kind of public demonstrations. I've never considered myself an activist, but I've always shown up to stuff when there were demonstrations. And I've seen riots unfold as well. You and I were both in Vancouver when the
stupid hockey riots
NHL
happened.
Hockey riots happened when Vancouver Canucks were going to lose when they lost the playoffs. It was like, are you fucking kidding me? We're lighting cars on fire and flipping cars and destroying windows and breaking apart businesses and stealing shit. Like, what I mean to say about this is people will flip into this insanity mode at the drop of a hat, like when things are not going well collectively.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember, but it was just in the air. Like when we were on the SkyTrain riding into downtown for the last game, it was like, I don't know what's going to happen with the game if they win or lose, but something's going down downtown. Yeah, like
people
you could feel
were
it.
People were wearing like bandanas around their face or around their neck, like being ready to put them over their face. People had backpacks on. It's like, oh yeah, you got a bunch of Molotov cocktails in there. I just know it. Yeah. And of course,
their laptops.
Oh yeah, either or. Well, I mean, it turned out that they did have Molotov cocktails.
So what I mean to say is that, like, things will get bad for stupid reasons, and this is actually a pretty good reason for things to get bad, in my opinion. Like, this is a reason that people are going to be like, fuck, I can't feed myself. This is a real emergency. It's not like past things that we've had an inkling of something to come. It's like, we're finally embodied in this problem now. We're having this problem now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason I wanted to talk about this UBI thing is that I've recognized a lot of these different movements over time, like the Occupy Wall Street, the, what was the latest one in London and all over the world?
Extinction Rebellion.
And a lot of these are like angry responses without real solutions. What are the solutions being proposed? What's the like actual list that is going to be executed? Who's responsible for it? And this is the first time I've ever felt like what goes on the protest sign actually has serious potential to be a real solution.
At least for the time being. At least until
this
pandemic is dealt with.
I'm glad you said that, because there's a difference between the emergency and then what I feel like about this, because I care about this subject a lot. I feel like this is something that goes forward into the future that could take a lot of years if it weren't for this specific event happening now. So it's like, what I think is going to happen is the emergency UBI will give people a taste of it. There will not need to be a ton of debate about whether it's necessary. It's like, do you want society to collapse or not? Okay, well, maybe this is a good solution. Not saying that as a threat, but saying it's highly likely it will collapse.
Yeah, it's just the combination of factors in the United States is especially ripe for this.
Yeah.
Because so many people work paycheck to paycheck. There is no socialized healthcare. There are a lot of guns.
Yeah.
And there's been growing discontent for a long time already.
Yeah.
And also huge prison population.
Mm-hmm.
So if for whatever reason those prisons can't be contained anymore and all those people roam free. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. Alex agrees.
One of the things that was just mentioned recently, Trump had been planning to cut 700,000 Americans from food stamps.
Yeah,
that's right. I heard that too.
There's just recently, I saw on Bloomberg that they canceled that now. It's like, okay, no, we're not going to do that now. So this is kind of, that's the wrong direction, obviously. You know, the UBI is actually even further in the direction of let's take care of people rather than trying to cut people off.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting change in perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes people think of this as kind of a socialist solution, but in this case, it's not. It's not politicized.
It's depoliticized, yeah.
Yeah. And there's nobody to point the finger at in this case. It's just like, well, unless you're a conspiracy theorist and you think that somebody released this virus on purpose, which still we don't know whether that's, you know, some people think that's the case, but there's no solid evidence.
Yeah.
In any case, yeah, it's depoliticized. So hopefully if this basic income is instituted, nobody is going to feel resentful about it.
There's a lot of problems that exacerbate the situation related to supply chains. I heard someone say recently that antidepressants are going to be hard to come by. There's a lot of different medicines and drugs that we get from China and India. I heard India is not letting a lot of drugs come into the US now because they think they're going to need it for this pandemic.
Yeah.
Same thing with China, I'm sure, as well. Manufacturing is just fucked everywhere.
Yeah, they produce a lot of the generic, cheaper versions. So the brand name ones might be produced in Western countries, but the cheaper generics are produced in China.
What floors me about this whole thing is how perfect it is at every level to get us to reflect on the way we live.
Yeah, really.
You know, that we've been living so precariously in so many different levels of society for so many years. And this is just suddenly highlighting all of those fragilities at once.
And you know, it's funny because it's been precarious, but at the same time, it's been optimized around super convenience. Like people don't keep anything in their fridge because everything is available at the store and they can go get it anytime. And things are delivered to your door, you know, Amazon, Insta delivery in the States. Mm-hmm. So people don't feel like they have to prepare. They don't feel like they have to stockpile. Everything is just on demand when they need it. But those supply chains are super fragile when something like this happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like our pretty much every generation before us had to have some sort of, you know, stockpile in their house. And that was just normal.
You know, it's one reason I've appreciated a lot of the countries we've traveled to over the years, including the one we now live in. The kind of buffed, polished surface of Western civilization hides an underbelly or hides the inner workings of how things come really together and how they really are. And I've always liked that kind of out there on the surface, like to be able to see edges. That. Yeah. To see where the problems are. I'd rather not, you know, it comes back to that example whenever we got stopped by police in Asia versus in Canada or the States. It's like, you know that there's a cost to getting out of this.
Yeah.
You don't know, like, you don't know how it's going to work behind the scenes. And yeah.
Yeah, there's kind of a known price for what you bribe the cops to get.
I'd rather the corruption. What I'm saying is, I'd rather the corruption be out there in the open than behind, you know, some wall that I can't see.
Yeah,
I'd rather the transparency.
In a lot of countries in the world, corruption is very it's very transparent and it's on the low levels, like it's at the everyday life level. Whereas in somewhere like United States, corruption is at the high level. So it's, you know, the banks getting bailouts and billionaires hiding their money in offshore accounts and things like that.
Not paying taxes.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I mean, I was following the Andrew Yang presidential campaign. Unfortunately, he was nowhere near getting close to being elected. But
baby.
One of the things that people would ask him, like, well, where's the money going to come from for UBI? Because that was the whole basis of his campaign. And he was saying, well, look at Amazon. Look how much money they get away with not paying in taxes. And then I saw that video of the rice representing, like, this guy had a table full of rice. And he said, each one of these grains represents $100,000. And he's like, to me, that's a lot of money. To you, that's probably a lot of money. And he kind of like puts together piles. Here's $1 million. Well, look what that looks like. And he's like, here is what Jeff Bezos's whole net worth is. And it's just like a 2-pound bag or something like that of rice. Billions upon billions of dollars. We don't have a concept of how much that is, but man, was that ever evident in that video?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, it's the corruption at the high level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is a question. I don't know if this is the right time to do it, but how does this get paid for? That was one of his suggestions, is like tax on the product.
Companies.
Yeah, to tax these companies. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably another conversation. It's
definitely something that I haven't prepped for to talk about. Hey everyone, just a reminder that for $5 a month, you'll get access to all of our full podcast episodes, unreleased material from past episodes, and occasional extra content from our courses, including guided meditations, lessons, and more. Plus, you'll be helping us keep the lights on.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
I do have a sense that, I mean, I grew up being told that you should work for what you get. Work for everything you get. And I know that the people in my hometown still feel that way. Like, there's no handouts. There's no freebies. This is not a welfare system. But as I've gone through the last several years and looked at automation, looked at the advancements, it's very easy to see that we are wrapped up in a system of global centralized ways to get food and energy and communication and a lot of other things. And we have to pay to be able to play any of these games. There's no such thing as like going off on your own farm and make, you know, starting a garden and having your solar panels and all this stuff. Like the system kind of makes that really difficult and taxes it to a point where it's actually nearly impossible to do that in a lot of countries. So we have this built-in dependency on the system. And what we have to do now to get by is far more than we ever used to have to do to get by. To just pay the bills, to pay your, you know, tuition fees, to get groceries, to pay the rent, all of that stuff. It's full-time work. And I just think that's not right. That's not the same as you should work for what you get. We have the ability to feed people and produce. We overproduce enough for everybody. So I think this is quite the opportunity to show people what life could be like. just by having a taste of what this emergency relief would look like.
Yeah.
If I could,
yeah,
just hop in. One of the things to think about is it's the mindset shift is that we have been in a situation where the illusion of individual, the individual as primary, as sovereign, as, you know, that each person is like you said, you don't rely on handouts, you make it on your own. But that's an illusion. You know, nobody's making it on their own. We're all really working together. The sense of it based on the relational component that we're all working together on this is that part's hidden. And so this is something it seems like a frame shift and a mindset shift where, oh no, that the relational component is more important than we knew. If we only focus on the individual making it on their own, we're not going to make it past this point.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the social distancing is now getting implemented by so many countries in order to stop the spread of the pandemic. But that doesn't mean that we're actually going to be isolated. It doesn't have to mean that anyway. And a lot of the time in a crisis, especially in a major existential crisis like this that affects everybody, people can become more altruistic and, you know, they might be more likely to actually want to help. So I think that's really important to remember, that this social distancing doesn't have to mean that we're all going to be just alone in our apartments. We can, you know, we can connect with our loved ones and our neighbors, and we can see what ways we can help others.
I'm just checking out the comments here. There's some really good stuff here. Someone says, I can remember it anyway. Oh yeah, there it is. My husband told me that the most popular ammo was out of stock at large outdoor sportsman stores.
Yeah, I've seen that actually. I've seen that on Twitter as well. People are saying that they they've stocked up on ammo, but now they feel they don't have enough.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, there's your sign. I mean, when we were on the SkyTrain, that was the same kind of feeling. It's like people are talking in such a way and prepping and taking action in such a way that you know
something's
something's going to go wrong here.
Yeah.
I think this is an opportunity to mitigate that by sharing this information. One thing I would suggest would be to tag MPs and presidents and
your local
prime ministers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think start the hashtag is emergency UBI.
Yeah.
That's going around on Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Emergency fist in mouth.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I just heard today? So Bulgaria is on lockdown, and there's going to be the largest military exercise that American Army has undertaken in I don't know how long. That's going to have 25,000 military personnel doing some sort of an exercise around here while everybody's on lockdown. Like, does that not sound
wrong?
Like suspicious? Like something's up? Yeah.
Yeah. There's an air base or something here. American.
Yeah. There's
air base.
An American air base here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is kind of a get ahead of this moment. You know, we have to get ahead of this moment. But I don't know. I'm pessimistic about that as well, because look at how people have been responding, especially in the West. Look at how people have been responding just to deal with the virus itself, never mind downstream effects.
Yeah, people are not taking it seriously at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, here people have started taking it seriously when the government shut everything down and imposed strict fines and even jail time for breaking certain laws in regard to this.
By the way, someone asked the question, who is the other, who's the voice in the background? That's David Swetlow. He's been in a lot of our videos before. He's in our members area, contributes a lot there. So yeah, David, you were going to say.
I was just going to say that we're talking a little bit about authoritarian possibilities versus decentralized possibilities. And I think that it's really difficult to know what is most effective. You know, there's going to be, I think one of the things that's going to be really important is for citizens to be able to feedback to be able to use social media as much as possible to let people know what's happening.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of social media, the mainstream media has been so useless in reporting on this accurately. I found... Oh, buddy.
Hi. Look, you're on internet TV.
Yeah, I found the best sense making to be on Twitter, actually. Just different public intellectuals and people who are interested in complex systems, and some epidemiologists, some virologists. You know, there's Dr. John Campbell on YouTube, who's been doing daily updates.
There's a lot of good sense making happening out there.
But it's not coming from mainstream media or authorities or, you know, experts.
You know, yeah, I think that, David, that was a really good thing to bring up. Because people are going to look at this in quite a binary way. Is this like liberal democratic way of running a country, working out in situations like this? And clearly in the United States, it's not working out. In the UK, it's not working out. In Canada, it's not really working out. But we're kind of continually divided between this binary view of how we operate as society. And I've been thinking that there's going to be, like, there's something we've never tried, which is this decentralized totalitarian government.
Be careful what you propose.
I know. But I mean, related to what we've been interested in blockchain for so long, to have like decision making more distributed, but in an electronic way, and we're not sending horses across the fucking continent to deliver messages. Like, representative democracy is broken. This is not working. But we could do something new that's like a little more efficient, a little faster in decision making. There's lots of software out there to help us make decisions. We even know people in our community who are building these kinds of apps. Like, we're still running democracies off of 500-year-old technology, and that could change. And this could make us still have the benefits of being democratic and being open and free and liberal. But then when things need to happen, we can have experts agree rather than politicians agreeing that something needs to be done and then action is taken. Like, if you know, let's say that someone like Dr. John Campbell, if you had a liquid democracy or distributed democracy in a situation like this, he would have a lot more weight in his vote. And there'd be people like him that would have higher weight in what to do, like policies to institute. So we might see, instead of like trying to fight with some politician who's got his own set of agendas, maybe it would be better to have different areas of our politics and government distributed depending on the people working in those fields.
Yeah,
I know you hate this idea.
I really have a lot of issues with liquid democracy, because people are not rational or logical, especially under stress. And, you know, people can be coerced and manipulated into giving up their votes if like the liquid democracy system that relies on people giving up their votes to so-called experts. And it can also turn into a popularity contest where, you know, people can pose as experts but actually not know what they're talking about in a crisis situation and make a bad decision.
Yeah, you know, I don't have something to propose. I'm just saying that, like, maybe the 500-year-old tech we're using for this is something to be updated. Maybe paper ballots, and maybe voting on some dude to represent an entire country is not the right thing, you know?
Yeah,
that's pretty obvious. We could agree on that.
We can
as far
on
as what
that.
The solution is, in maybe it's not binary, maybe it's not communism or fascism or whatever this liberal version of government is right now. Maybe it's not those things. Maybe it's something that's never been tried.
Yeah,
but it's pretty clear that in Western countries right now, the response has been pretty bad.
Yeah, it's been really inadequate.
Yeah, and places that have had both exposure to hardships and or to related events, who've had practice rounds and then have the ability to deploy sweeping changes and movements quickly. Like, that seems to be a winning factor here.
Yeah. So it seems that the countries that have had the best outcomes so far, and that's actually not even, we can't conclusively say, yeah, you know, good job, because it's not over yet. It's just starting.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it plays out long term. But so far, it's been Hong Kong, Japan, to a lesser degree, South Korea, that have done a really good job. Singapore as well. in slowing down the spread of the infection. And in China, they did it with these extreme lockdowns. And, you know, basically they would arrest people who broke quarantine. And in Korea, they had really widespread testing. So they were able to trace the clusters of infections and isolate people really well. In Singapore, and this is kind of a more surveillance-y option, they actually like tagged people who were infected. And so you would know who was infected in your area. Like you wouldn't see their name, but you would see their location and, you know, maybe case number or something. I'm not sure exactly how it looked on the, you know, on the app, but they had a technological solution. And so that's how they were able to do very effective, very specific social distancing. Mm. Yeah. And in Hong Kong, I think they closed things really early on. Like they closed schools and universities and they were able to slow things down that way. But yeah, like those four countries had way better outcomes in slowing things down. And therefore, their hospitals weren't overloaded and they had a very low death rate because of that. And low morbidity rate, because it's not just death rate. Like there's a very sizable chunk of the people who get infected who actually get lifelong complications from this. And because it's so new, we don't even know what the outcomes are like 5 years down the road. But so far, we can already see that there's like permanent lung damage. There's cases of infertility in men. There's permanent heart damage, like organ damage. They found that it can even infect the nervous system if it gets bad enough. So all that stuff is obviously going to have causes societally and also, you know, in mm-hmm. people's lives for years to come. So, yeah, just looking at the death rate is not enough, but it's still a, you know, significant factor that we can see that slowing down the infection helps reduce that.
Yeah.
And so this is, speaking of slowing things down, in UK, they are trying to implement this a completely different strategy where they just say, okay, let's get everybody infected and then we'll have herd immunity. And then that's how we'll just like get it over with quickly. Which, whew, yeah, I know it's a very, very risky strategy. So if you had a pathogen that was already known, like the flu, you know, that we have vaccines for, we have treatments for, we, you know, it's a beast we know. More or less. Whereas this is a completely new thing. And if you've seen reports from Chinese doctors from the front lines, like who are actually dealing with this, they say it's like SARS plus AIDS. Like right. it can have really, really, it really wrecks the body, especially for people who are have weaker immune systems or have pre-existing conditions. But even in Italy now, they're seeing young people get serious complications to this, like, you know, lung failure and other stuff. So it's not just an old person's disease, and it is very serious. So when you just like let it rip through the population, their death rate is going to be huge. And and the comorbidities as well, you know, like because they're simply not going to have enough beds and enough ventilators and enough doctors to deal with this. So I mean, we're gonna have to see. And oh yeah, and there's another thing. So we don't even know if people develop immunity after they are done with this disease. We don't know that. So yes, it's a coronavirus, which means it's similar to the flu. It's in the same family of diseases, and people do develop an immunity to the flu, but the flu mutates every year. So they develop an immunity to one strain, then next year there's a new strain, they don't have immunity. So it's possible that the same thing could happen with this. So, you know, they let it rip through the population, kill a big chunk. Some people get immunity and then it mutates. And then what? Yeah. So, yeah. But we don't know.
The other factor is that while they say that a lot of children seem to not get it, we don't know if it may be going into the body and doing something waiting in the background to be expressed somehow differently at a later time.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the effects that are kind of HIV, similar to HIV, that the Chinese doctors noticed, that it causes It can cause, you know, organ failure or just cause your systems to operate improperly, or causes immunodeficiency. And that kind of stuff can be very long-term. It can have long-term consequences. And, you know, with HIV, for example, it takes a really long time to develop. It can take years before it really starts wrecking you. So this is a novel infection. We don't know what the long-term effects are.
Yeah.
So we can't really be playing fast and loose with something like this. Yeah.
And whatever decisions we are making, we need to be tracking those. We need to be able to have the capacity to implement some sort of feedback loop about what decisions were made, what sort of short-term impacts and what sort of long-term impacts are we starting to see. That's one of the things that's challenging, is right now we're just reacting to the immediate needs, and we need to start responding more broadly. And it's a transition. I mean, obviously there are emergency things to be doing right now, but we need to start thinking about collecting the kind of data that will help us make better long-term decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are always things happening in the background in a crisis like this, where, you know, while our attention is over here, there are different entities that might take that as an opportunity to do something over there. So I think it's really important for us to try to increase our individual and collective sovereignty and discernment, to try to determine what is fake and what is real. And that's really difficult, I know that. But I think it is worth putting our attention onto.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I mean, that's what I mentioned earlier about the three priorities. That's a big one. Like, how do we process? Because becoming sovereign is so related to how you process your emotions.
Yeah. But this is not just sovereignty. It's also discernment. Like, mm-hmm. Can you tell the quality of this information that's coming to you? Can you tell if it's real or fake?
You can't, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's about not attaching to wanting one outcome over another. That's how you make better sense, is just to not take your own desire out of it and observe what is as much as possible without trying to filter your desire into it. People don't do that on purpose, but you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
to try and remove your desire for the outcome so that you can see things a little more unbiased.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not much, yeah.
Yeah, my point is, like, there was this rumor circulating that U.S. is going to go on full lockdown. And then the CDC came out and said, no, this is fake news. So now we're not in the U.S., but we have a lot of friends in the U.S. So nobody knows what the actual situation is, where that information came. Was it, you know, disseminated through the networks on purpose to create some sort of a response? Was it just like a rumor that developed on its own? Is it actually something that's going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Like, it's consequential for people. So yeah, you can say, like, yeah, you know, detach from wanting a certain outcome, but people might actually be making major life decisions based on that information.
Oh, I know. I'm not saying it's an easy thing, but still doing it produces better sense making. That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy. I mean, if I have to make hard decisions with our family, it's not mm-hmm. going to be like, I have definite preferences.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, that's what colors people's decisions the most. That's what makes things hard. That's what makes people not want to face truth and make decisions that are counter to their well-being. You know, that's why states have been so slow to respond, because you've got an entire population that has not had a ton of exposure to real, you know, global hardship in the last 20 years. And suddenly they have to face some really hard truths. Individuals, members of society have to face hard truths. And it's like, a lot of people are just not willing to do that.
Yeah.
People, and so they deny its existence altogether.
Yeah. They don't want to change their lifestyles. They don't want to give up conveniences.
Yeah.
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 And we've known people like that, who just outright said, I'm just going to sit back and do nothing.
Yeah. Not you.
He's busy. Yeah.
Someone in the comments said that that Dr. Campbell recently noted that it looks like people do build immunity, that the cases where it looked like somebody may have reacquired it. It was a case where it didn't actually go away. But again, so that's Dr. Campbell, who's pretty cautious with what he says. And at the same time, it's still early. So it's like, we have to keep evaluating that. But it does look like there may be a possibility that we're not, that people are building immunity with this.
I saw that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that doesn't prevent people from getting reinfected by mutation by a different strand.
Exactly. And it's as fast as this is spreading, it seems like it's likely that it's going to mutate.
And there's already two strands circulating, actually.
Yeah.
So one is more severe than the other.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything else that we want to talk about today? What are some of the other downstream effects? So one, actually, I'll mention this quickly. One thing that could happen is that there are either copycat attacks or pylon attacks. So it's something that Jordan Hall, he wrote a really great article summarizing a lot of these kinds of effects that are likely going to happen or could happen anyway. And so, you know, with this kind of crisis, if somebody wanted to do a bioweapon attack or cyber attack, because people are more vulnerable, they're not paying attention, and there's already this pathogen circulating, you know, now it would be the time to do that. So it's possible that we might see kind of, you know, other things happening. And something that Joe Brewer mentioned is that a lot of the time in nature, when you have one kind of natural disaster, there's often clusters of other natural disasters because it's a system, right? So things are connected. So when one thing is off balance, it causes other things to backfire as well.
Yeah.
So we could also see natural things going down that might further destabilize systems.
I am curious, and this would just be an exercise, but I'm curious to kind of visualize this outcome. Let's say, you know, a certain amount of time passes and an emergency UBI is utilized. Which of these downstream effects are actually rendered ineffective or not a problem?
Well, the financial precarity.
Yeah.
Is definitely at least it would take the edge off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the medical question as well, it would potentially produce better outcomes.
It would only ever be $1,000 or maybe a little bit more. Yeah. So it's not, you know, the American medical system's pretty messed up still.
Yeah, but that's probably not going to have much of an effect. And especially because the medical system, the choke point there is the number of ventilators and the number of doctors and the beds available,
right,
which is limited, and it's not going to be improved by UBI. So it's mainly just, taking off the financially precarious situation. So what that's going to improve is probably the mental well-being of people.
Mm-hmm. Which also has an effect on immunity.
Yes, absolutely. People, when they're under stress, it worsens their immunity. Also, it'll probably have an effect on domestic violence and things like that, because when people are in a very precarious situation, it always exasperates domestic violence. And people's dependency on others who might not actually be good for them. So, for example, let's say, you know, single mom might have to go back to her abusive ex-husband because he has resources. If she has UBI, she doesn't have to do that.
Yeah. He's very wet. Ugh. Dude.
Yeah. So, people might feel like they actually have hope. They might feel like they can, you know, survive this if they see that light at the end of the tunnel, that they have this bit of support. It might reduce the rates of suicide and depression and things like that.
Yeah.
Theoretically, anyway.
What were some of the other downstream effects that you've mentioned or that we've seen? Actually, the one that Jordan Hall, or the big list that Jordan Hall posted, so that would be worth.
The first one was medical system collapse.
Yeah.
Second is the financial issues. Third one is broad societal financial collapse. So UBI might actually help for this because it keeps the economy circulating, keeps the money circulating.
Yeah.
So it might have some positive effects because a cash shortage. So in 2008 financial crisis, it was not a cash shortage. It was like they were able to fix it at the bank level. In this case, it's a cash shortage. So there's simply people are not buying. So it doesn't matter if you're selling things super cheap or if you're, you know, giving it away, just people aren't buying. So, but if you inject cash into society with a UBI, it might actually help.
Yeah.
I mean, the other question is like, do we want to keep this financial system going, or is it, you know, is it time for a renewal? Then again,
a calling.
Then again, in a collapse, it always has cascading effects. So it's preferable to have a more smooth transition rather than, you know, just let things die.
Yeah.
Next, okay, so there was the copycat attacks.
Which a lot of that kind of the attack is related to the nihilism and Joker kind of meme of wanting to reflect the world back at itself. You know, Jordan Peterson has talked about this a ton, the young man that hits the bottom and then decides society is wrong and fucked and now I want to destroy all of that. A lot of that would change if people weren't so stuck at the bottom. So that's another thing I think would actually have a very positive effect. Crime rate, that's obvious, right?
Crime rate, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can look at the studies of UBI that they've done in different places and see the positive effects. Like, you know, domestic abuse goes down significantly. Entrepreneurship goes up. Teenage pregnancies go down. Kids staying in schools goes up.
The entrepreneurship
crime
question,
goes down.
That's a good one. Like the ability to innovate, pursue projects people want to do but can't because they're stuck.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different things like that that I think we can't predict how positive of an impact there would be.
Yeah, and especially now when a lot of people might be feeling more altruistic or like they really want to help out and like they're going to be needed. And if they have that bit of a safety net, it might enable them to do that. So it could, it may well, you know, produce a bunch of projects that might be very pro-social and helpful.
Yeah.
Let's see. The next, there was, well, authoritarianism. So that's actually a risk of that. It goes up when you have UBI. Because when you have people by the balls with this UBI, then there is a precedent to, you know, increase surveillance, increase different rules. So that's a risk.
You know, I've heard you mention that. I've heard other people mention that before. But the system, like we mentioned before, the system that we're locked into already has us by the balls. So if you take away our slave wage and give us a free wage, it's not, the outcome is not that much different. We're still dependent, except that in one of these scenarios, we have something, and in another one, we have nothing.
It's different because the entity that is providing the wage is different. Right. So the feedback loop is very direct.
Good point.
In the case of UBI, it's the government providing the money, so the government can have rules that come along with that money.
Yeah.
So, you know, they could institute some sort of a social credit score. Like if your social credit score goes below a certain range, then you don't get the UBI. And they can include any number of rules in that. Like, you know, this is what they use to control people in China in this lockdown. I'm sure they used the social credit score. Like if you leave quarantine, if you get out of your house, or if you like, you know, post on social media about anything that's actually going down, your social credit score goes down, then you can't get a mortgage, can't get a job, can't get a plane ticket, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important that if this UBI goes into effect, that people review it. People who understand these questions, understand these possibilities. Make sure that it doesn't come with these rules attached. That still leaves the possibility that they might get attached later once people are already receiving the money.
Yeah.
And that's going to be difficult to prevent. But so I'm just saying this because people will just have to keep an eye on this.
Yeah. I think this is probably a place we should wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's starting to get cranky. David, thanks for doing the camera switching and adding some
comments
stuff to the conversation. Alex, thank you for being mostly okay. you're pretty wet though, so that's a little gross. Yuvi, thanks for, you know, doing what you do.
me, thanks for looking so good, and we'll see you next time.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month, we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.